feeling is the remote. Globe, more than 531,000 people have lost their lives to COVID-19 since it surfaced in China late last year. The United States has the highest death toll with more than 129,000 deaths. It's followed by Brazil with over 64,000 deaths and Britain with over 44,000 fatalities. Rising coronavirus cases in 39 U.S. states cast a shadow on 4th of July celebrations this weekend, with health experts worrying that holiday parties would quicken the infection spread. After towns and cities across the country canceled fireworks displays to avoid large crowds, many Americans got together themselves to make merry. Meantime, in the first 4 days of July alone, 15 states have reported record increases in new cases of COVID-19. Florida's cases have risen by over 10,000 for 3 out of the last 4 days, including climbing by 10,059 on Sunday, surpassing the highest daily tally reported by any European country during the height of its coronavirus outbreak. U.S. President Donald Trump has refused to wear a mask in public and has been reluctant to encourage Americans to do so, saying it's a personal choice. A July 4th celebration he attended at Mount Rushmore in South Dakota was mask optional. And authorities in a Chinese region of Inner Mongolia issued a bubonic plague health warning Sunday, one day after a hospital reported a case of suspected bubonic plague. The alert forbids the hunting and eating of animals that could carry plague and asks the public to report suspected cases. The bubonic plague, known as the Black Death in the Middle Ages, is a highly infectious disease that spread mostly by rodents. Plague cases are not uncommon in China, but outbreaks have become rare. This is VOA News. Visitors to India's Taj Mahal will have to wear masks at all times and keep their distance when the 17th century monument reopens Monday after a 3-month COVID-19 shutdown. 5,000 tourists will be allowed in a day, split into two groups. It's a long way from peak levels of 80,000 visitors a day in the past. On Sunday, the health ministry reported a record single-day spike of 24,850 new cases and more than 600 deaths, pushing the overall case tally to over 673,000 and closing in on Russia, the third most affected country globally. But the government has been lifting a vast lockdown of India's 1.3 billion people that's left tens of thousands without work and shuttered businesses. While international flights remain suspended, domestic travel has been opened up, and the government is hoping visitors will start to trickle back to some popular destinations. The Ethiopian government reports Sunday that more than 166 people were killed during anti-government protests in that country last week. This, as the capital and other hotspots remain closely guarded by security forces, and a blanket internet shutdown entered its sixth day. Large protests broke out in Addis Ababa and spread to the surrounding Oromia region on Monday after a popular Oromo musician was shot dead by unknown gunmen in a killing the prime minister, who is also Oromo, said was an evil act. Killing tapped into grievances fueled by decades of government repression and what the Oromo describe as their historic exclusion from political power. Sudan's police chief and his deputy were fired Sunday, the transitional government said, days after large protests demanding more measures against officials linked to ousted President Omar al-Bashir. One person was killed and several others injured during largely peaceful demonstrations across Sudan on Tuesday, as tens of thousands of people took to the streets, demanding faster reform and a greater role for civilians in the country's transition towards democracy. Protesters and pro-democracy groups linked the two fired police officials with the administration of Bashir, who was removed from power in April 2019 after months of protest. A pair of rocket attacks targeted American diplomatic and military installations overnight. This, according to Iraq's security forces on Sunday. Since October, U.S. diplomats and troops across Iraq have been targeted by around 36 missile attacks. Washington's blaming them on pro-Iranian forces. This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We feel that Malawi is capable. Its people are capable and very passionate, very willing to help their country develop. And Chakwera is just going to be on the driving seat, driving Malawi forward with everybody on board.
The government of Malawi plans a ceremony to officially introduce President Chakwera and Vice President Chilima to the public Monday.
We have a convention making sure that our manifesto is ready after we're done with all those. That's when now we start thinking of alliance. And for us, it is the people of Zambia who have to tell us going to an alliance. We will not go into an alliance for selfish reasons.
A major Zambian opposition party implements measures to unite members ahead of next year's general election.
It will be erroneous to be able to try to resolve this conflict by looking only at political actions and military actions, because that would be a fallacy. We will be losing out on good data from the affected population and their contribution, because civil society remains the bridge that exists between the government and its people.
And a major Cameroonian civil society group demands immediate ceasefire to help end the ongoing conflict. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The government of Malawi is planning a ceremony to officially introduce newly installed President Dr. Lazarus Chakwera and his Vice President Dr. Salos Chilima to the public in the capital Lilongwe Monday. Maurice Muntali, spokesperson for the now ruling Malawi Congress Party or MCP, says the ceremony is expected to attract Malawians from all parts of the country to celebrate the country's burgeoning democracy. Analysts say the newly installed president and his team should implement measures to ease the tensions leading up to the recent elections. They are also saying that extending an olive branch to the former president, his supporters, and the now new opposition Democratic Progressive Party or DPP would be a good step to ease the tensions. Maurice Muntali tells me that it is in the nature of President Chakwera to seek peace and resolve tensions.
Yeah, this is now the government of the Republic of Malawi organizing this ceremony. In fact, what is going to happen on Monday is unveiling the presidency, and this is in Dr. Lazarus Chakwera and his vice, Dr. Salos Chilima, to the general public, to the Malawian nation, showing openly that the President Chakwera is now the president and the vice president is now Salos Chilima. The ceremony is being organized by the government, and we as a party, we are only going to be celebrating that our candidate is now ushered into the presidency, and that we are going to be ruling for the next 5 years.
Now, what is the significance of this program or ceremony?
It is only openly saying or publicly saying that Dr. Lazarus Chakwera won the presidency, and this is also showing to the Malawian nation that it was a very fair election. He won credibly, and that he has to be unveiled. So the importance of this is that Malawians are now looking at a new leader. They are now looking at a new Malawi. They are looking into their future with hope. So Chakwera is a pillar of hope, a symbol of hope, and that Malawians are now rejoicing that finally they can now enjoy their own country.
We know that President Chakwera has made a few appointments into government while he continues to unveil the rest of his government. How soon should Malawians expect a full array of those he seeks to work with to administer the affairs of Malawians for the people?
You know, Peter, that is the preserve of the president. That is his prerogative. We do not want to step into the field of the president and his preserve. But I can assure Malawians that Dr. Lazarus Chakwera is going to unveil his cabinet very shortly, because he knows how important the cabinet is to him and the Malawi nation and the running of the affairs of government.
Mr. Muntali, there are some concerns that because there seem to have been tensions leading up to the elections and the previous election, which was annulled, the presidential outcome that is, some people are suggesting that President Chakwera should extend a hand or an olive branch to try to ease the political temperature in the country as he seeks to govern. What is your take on that?
That is what Chakwera has already started saying. In fact, during his swearing-in ceremony, he said, even those who did not vote for him, he is their president. And when we're talking of a new Malawi, a Malawi that is fair for all, it means even those who did not vote for him, they are going to enjoy the fruits of his leadership. So he's already extended an olive branch to everybody, and that includes Peter Mutharika himself and everybody who was in government.
Now, some people are suggesting that the bar of expectations of Malawi for the president to improve their living conditions and crack down on corruption is so high, and they wonder if President Chakwera is capable or meet his promise of meeting this challenge and improving the living conditions of Malawians, as well as ensuring that the loopholes for which corruption thrived in Malawi will be blocked so that the people can feel confident in the people of President Chakwera, whom they voted for.
Chakwera believes in the strength of the government institutions. If government institutions will be left to work independently, professionally, and without undue pressure from politics, then Malawi is going to thrive. Because it is not just Chakwera. Chakwera trusts in the wisdom, the expertise, professionalism of all Malawians. But as long as we let the institutions, the public institutions, serve Malawians professionally and in the manner they were governed, Malawi is going to deliver. And the promises were not made from the air. These promises are practical. They are doable because Malawi has money, only that the money was being plundered. Chakwera is going to stamp out corruption, and Malawians should listen to what he's going to say on Monday, because Malawi got rotten because the resources went into pockets of few people. So all what was promised by the Tosi Alliance under the leadership of Dr. Lazarus Chakwera is going to be provided, is going to be implemented, and the Malawians should expect just that, because we feel that Malawi is capable. Its people are capable and very passionate, very willing to help their country develop. And Chakwera is just going to be on the driving seat, driving Malawi forward with everybody on board.
Maurice Muntali is the spokesperson for the Malawi Congress Party, or MCP. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. In Zambia, the opposition party, the New Hope Movement for Multi-Party Democracy, or MMD, says it is implementing measures to defeat a petition seeking to disband the group. The remark comes after the Constitutional Court was petitioned to deregister any political party that has failed to practice the tenet of democracy since 2016. The opposition MMD says it will defend itself at the court because the outcome of the petition is likely to affect the group's prospects ahead of next year's general election. Gregory Mofu, Deputy General Secretary of the MMD, says since the court ruling, the MMD has been implementing measures to organize a congress which will involve the grassroots. But critics say the MMD has lost time and is unlikely to play a key role in the effort to challenge incumbent President Edgar Lungu and his governing Patriotic Front Party, or PF. Mr. Mofu tells me that the MMD is in the process of pulling itself together and will become a significant force in next year's polls.
I can confirm that we, as the MMD, through the National Secretary, Honorable Elizabeth Shitika, we petitioned the court to join the petition as defendant in that case, because we have not had a convention since 2016. So we believe if judge rules in favor of the lawyer, who is Mr. Mwelwa, it will affect us bad. So we wanted to tell our story why we've not had a convention. Because under the new amendment constitution of 2016, it mandates every political party to have regular conventions in 5 years. So that is why we as MMD have decided to join as defendants and tell our story of why we didn't have a convention.
While in court, what measures or mechanisms has the new leadership of MMD put in place in order to ensure that you meet these obligations of the provision of the constitution, so your party is not deregistered if indeed the court rules in favor of the attorney seeking for parties to be deregistered?
Firstly, it is the same court that gave us back the party as the MMD. It's the same court that ruled that the convention that our colleagues held in 2016, led by Mr. Felix Mutati, was illegal. And they have given us the authority. They understood why we never had the convention then, and they have told us to have the convention. So right now, we are having primaries at grassroots, which will build up to the provincial conferences and finally the convention. In fact, we're supposed to have the convention by now, but it's because of the COVID-19. So we will tell them that it is you, the court yourself, who have given us the go-away to have a convention. You understood why we never had a convention. So we were here with our colleagues in this same court. So those are part of the mechanism and some others. We will tell our story in court.
Gregu, some people are suggesting that the MMD, your political party, is a spent force and that the party's glory days are way past and that perhaps you should give up because you have failed to be a political force that could potentially challenge the ruling Patriotic Front Party and President Edgar Chagwa Lungu in next year's general election. What's your response to that?
MMD is a well-trusted name among the people of Zambia. The people of Zambia miss MMD. Whenever you throw a stone in any direction in Zambia, to land at a place or among people who say we miss MMD. Life was better under MMD. It is open gossip. The villagers, the farmers are missing MMD. Civil servants are missing MMD. Students at universities are missing MMD. So for them to argue that we're spent for the misplaced argument, those people are afraid of the New Hope MMD being led by Dr. Nevers. Those people are afraid that we will bounce back into power next year and sort out corruption. To us, those arguments are basically a storm in a teacup. They don't hold water.
Now, Mr. Mufu, looking at what you have now as the MMD, some people say it's a skeletal part of itself, a shadow of itself in time past. What do you think are the electoral prospects of the party come next year's general election?
The people should understand that the MMD that was rejected in 2011 when we lost power is not the MMD of today. Dr. Nevers Mumba was not in that MMD. He was in Canada. I, myself, I'm a 30-year-old youth who is the Deputy National Secretary. I was not in MMD at that time. There is a new brand of leaders that the MMD has right now, who the people of Zambia are looking forward. Wherever we go, just last month, I was in Eastern Province with Dr. Nevers Akwila Mumba, and everyone there, starting from the street vendors up to the chiefs, were so excited. No, we are happy that MMD is back. People will be in for a rude shock. Malawi has given us an example that a former ruling party led by Pastor has bounced back into power. So even in Zambia, the former ruling party led by Pastor is the MMD. So we are ready to bounce back next year.
Talking about a comparison between Malawi and Zambia, in Malawi you realize there was a big alliance known as the Tonse Alliance between the MCP, the Malawi Congress Party, and the UTM, the United Transformation Movement. Is there any plan of the MMD to enter into an alliance, since an opposition party has an objective and other opposition parties have one objective to get rid of the ruling party, politically speak? Do you have any chance or plans at all to enter into an alliance to realize your objective of winning next year's general election?
We in Zambia once had a vice president who was asked a question. He formed a party later on. He was asked a question about forming alliances. He mentioned that we'll decide to cross that bridge when we reach there. Even the Tonse Alliance, in the first election, there was no alliance. These people went in it alone. And afterwards, that's when they realized, when they saw their strength, it's too early to enter into an alliance. Right now, we as the MMD, because we were in court for 3 years, we are mobilizing our party, making sure that we have a convention, making sure that our manifesto is ready. After we're done with all those, that's when now we start thinking of alliance. And for us, it is the people of Zambia who have to tell us to go into an alliance. We will not go into an alliance for selfish reasons.
Gregory Mofu is the Deputy General Secretary of the MMD. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. A Cameroonian government official has reportedly met representatives of separatist groups. The meeting was aimed at finding solutions to the conflict which has displaced thousands of residents in the English-speaking parts of the country. However, critics of the government expressed skepticism about the meeting. They say the meeting and the anticipated talks do not appear to be genuine. They also say the administration often comes up with such actions after coming under pressure from the international community to resolve the conflict. Dr. Nick Ngwanyam is the president of the St. Louis University Institute Institute with branches in the commercial capital Douala and Bamenda. He tells me that a transparent and genuine dialogue between the government and the separatists could help end the ongoing crisis.
You know, each time you deal with people and if you break the trust and confidence goes out through the window, it becomes very difficult to be trusted. And therefore, yes, when government announces something like this, everybody is kind of like skeptical and finds it very difficult to believe what is going to come out of it, because we've seen this happen several times before. But, you know, if the thing is, if they had been doing the right things ever since they started, the war would have stopped. But now, 4 years counting, many people have died, a lot has been destroyed. But we have to all come to our senses and realize that the war has got to stop one way or the other. And we also understand that if the international community comes in to begin to help us, then that would make a bad situation worse sometimes. So I guess the government has got to a position where it realizes that she had better solve the problem herself. Because like you said, and as many people have observed, we had the major national dialogue, and that if that dialogue were genuine and sincere, the war would have stopped a long time ago.
So Dr. Ngwenyam, what is the best way forward? Because the government continues to call these separatists terrorists, and they have not refused or stopped using that term. Now, how do you negotiate with terrorists, since the position of the government remains that you don't negotiate with terrorists, and that negotiating with terrorists will encourage more intransigence? So what is the best way forward, in spite of the fact that the government realizes that there's need for discussion or dialogue to end this conflict?
If you remember very well, if a few months ago, our president, His Excellency President Paul Biya, was in Paris in an interview that was televised to the whole world, and the host was Mr. Mo Ibrahim. And the president himself acknowledged there that for the last 60 years, what the Francophones have been trying to do has been to squeeze the Anglophones and make them into Francophones or something of that sort. And therefore, the secret agenda had always been to marginalize the Anglophones and push them to the walls and damage every other thing that makes them seem to be and look different. And he acknowledged that thing has not worked and that it was time to let the Anglophones be. And that was a major declaration, and that's one of the most important things that anybody in power has said so far. So that's what we should hang on and get this problem solved. We just need to be truthful. The government needs to be truthful. The separatists or whoever, they need to be truthful. All Cameroonians need to be truthful, and we should have to face this truth in love. And the first truth is that Anglophones have been marginalized. And the second truth is that there should be some sort of talks, negotiation, so that there should be some peace. It's not important what names Anglophones are called or whatever, using the word separatists and so on. Those are just names, and what is in the name? What is important is for us to do what we've got to do to have peace. Again, the couple of ingredients that have been missing from the soup has been the absence of truth, has been the absence of love, and has been the absence of respect for each other. When these things are brought to the table, there will be a solution and there will be a way out. It's just human nature that is keeping us in the dark. Otherwise, solving this problem from the time the hostilities broke out, if we didn't need to be fighting for all these years, you know, if we really were sincere, we needed just 1 month to look at the truth and solve the problems and have everybody go about doing their business.
Well, some people are suggesting that although there could be problems if the international community steps in, they are saying that political pressure, including sanctions, should be applied to the key actors in the Cameroonian conflict, that they said will ensure that there is some seriousness and commitment on both sides to come into an agreement to solve this problem, so those who are caught in the crossfires of the conflict would have some respite. What do you say to that?
Yes, the international community is very, very important in solving these problems in Cameroon and elsewhere in the world. Yeah, it's good. As long as both sides respect what the international community is saying, and the international community has got some teeth to bite, but sometimes we wonder whether they're biting enough. If they were doing what they were supposed to do, this conflict would not have lasted this long. And then we have bodies like the Organization of African Unity, you know, the Toothless Bulldogs. But when we talk about the international community putting pressure, the pressure should be on both parties, on the government and on the separatists to do what is right. It shouldn't be like it's only the government that has to listen to the international community. Both sides have got to listen to the international community and face some sanctions or the other if they don't.
Dr. Nick Ngwanyam is the president of the St. Louis University Institute with branches in the Cameroonian commercial capital Douala and Bamenda. He spoke with me from the commercial capital Douala. Meanwhile, the Cameroonian Southwest and Northwest Women Task Force, a civil society organization, is calling for an immediate ceasefire between the government and the separatists. The group expressed concern that women and children continue to be caught in the crossfire in the conflict. This after a UN report says about 3,000 people have died and thousands displaced from their homes due to the ongoing violence. Sally Mbomian, president of the Cameroonian Southwest and Northwest Women Task Force, says it is unacceptable for women and the children to die as a result of the conflict. Ms. Mbomian tells me that a genuine dialogue to end the conflict and its associated crisis should include civil society and religious groups.
We, the Women's Southwest Northwest Women's Task Force, we believe that the solution lies in an immediate ceasefire. We call on all factions to have a head to a ceasefire because we believe that is the start. We have been bleeding for the past years. This conflict has been ongoing for 4 years. And as women, we have always been putting it clear that the immediate step is to call for a ceasefire so that we are sure that there is an end to hostilities. And when we have an end to hostilities, parties will be able to consult the population because they will be available, not running and hiding in bushes, so that their opinions and interests is safeguarded in whatever is going on.
This is not the first time the government has announced talks with the so-called separatists. Some suggest that from what they have gathered, the talks, as the government has announced, might not necessarily be genuine. What is your group saying about?
We would like to say here that parties to conflict must understand that the end point in all the violence that we have lived in our communities lies in them talking together in a negotiated settlement, being frank and transparent to each other. It should be an inclusive process that includes civil society, an inclusive process that includes civil society, other stakeholders, religious bodies, all key stakeholders in the country. So the women say it is always good to try and learn from past mistakes. Parties who boycotted should come on board and give their opinion. The government who organized the first major national dialogue should learn from its mistakes and try to see how they can talk and have an agreement that gives ownership to the process for all parties involved.
You made mention of sincere and genuine talks. Some are of the view that as long as the leaders of the so-called separatists are behind bars and being prosecuted by the military court, that does not generate goodwill on the part of government to negotiate transparently and without preconditions. What is your take on that?
We equally echo the importance of ownership in every peace process because we need to echo it here that a negotiated settlement is part of the peace process that is needed within the communities, just like the reconstruction. And if it is not owned by the people, then it will not solve the problems of the people. By extension, if we are talking about an inclusive and sincere dialogue, then every leader, every opinion holder must be part of this dialogue and on the table. And looking at the present circumstances in Cameroon, we will realize that the wisest thing and a good show of good faith on the part of the government will be to release the political prisoners because they too are leaders and opinion holders within the current conflict who have to be part of the dialogue table so that the process should gain acceptance and recognition by the people from whom it is meant.
Sally, some are suggesting in Cameroon that in order to expedite the negotiations and to bring people on board to ensure that the process is transparent and comprehensive, it must be limited and not necessarily involving every Tom, Dick and Harry. And they even question the inclusion of civil society groups, and that civil society groups and other stakeholders might not necessarily add any value to the talks to resolve it. What is your take?
In our opinion, as a task force, we believe that the grassroots population that have been the victims of this conflict, especially women and children, constitute a good database to discuss issues that usually pile up and lead to conflicts that escalate into the armed conflict that we have today. As the social injustices continue, people become disgruntled and they start fighting leadership at grassroots levels. And before we know it, it becomes a national issue and we have an armed conflict that we have. Amongst many other issues, it is not just the issue of the form of state. The question is, what brought about the form of state that is being discussed? It is the daily life of people within the union that has brought the discussion on the form of state. So it will be erroneous to be able to try to resolve this conflict by looking only at political actions and military actions, because that would be a fallacy. We will be losing out on good data from the affected population and their contribution, because civil society remains the bridge that exists between the government and its people.
Salim Boumien is the president of the Cameroonian Southwest and Northwest Women Task Force. She spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, Vanguard Africa, a non-profit organization, is organizing a virtual summit Wednesday. The theme is Resisting the Authoritarian Epidemic. Key on the agenda will be discussions on African autocratic leaders using the fight to stop the spread of the coronavirus to attack democracy and silence any dissent. Participants include Africa's top pro-democracy activists and opposition leaders. But some Africans say the so-called authoritarian African leaders have imposed orders and movement restrictions aimed at protecting the public by limiting the spread of the disease. They say the core mandate of any administration is to protect life and property, which they contend is currently being done by governments accused of being authoritarian. Jeffrey Smith, the founding director of Vanguard Africa, tells me that the discussion would not only focus on ways by which authoritarian governments are manipulating the global coronavirus pandemic to strengthen their hold on power, but also finding ways to protect democracy.
It's a program called the Resistance Bureau. This is actually going to be our inaugural episode, so we're very excited to launch this initiative and get it off the ground. As you mentioned, it's taking place on July 8th, so next Wednesday via Zoom, and you can register on our website, and I can get to that information a bit later on. But really quickly, this is going to be the first in the series programs designed to generate robust discussion on some of the most pressing issues that confront Africa today. So what we intend to do is bring together leading activists, civil society representatives, lawyers, journalists, and political leaders from across the continent to share stories, and most importantly, strategies and lessons learned on how to effectively resist democratic backsliding and repression. And to your question, you know, what we've seen over the past several months, not just across Africa, but truly across the globe, is authoritarian leaders becoming more emboldened and becoming more repressive, using the coronavirus pandemic as a convenient political excuse to clamp down on the opposition, to stifle the free press and independent journalists, and to entrench their own power. So we want to expose this. And in our first episode, as I mentioned, on July 8th, we'll be featuring some of Africa's leading opposition leaders. So Tundu Lissu from Tanzania, for example, will be a guest with us, as well as Fadzai Mahere from Zimbabwe, who is a spokeswoman for the leading pro-democracy opposition there, and Bobi Wine from Uganda, whom I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with. So very excited to have those speakers on our first show. And
let me ask you this, Jeff. Some people are suggesting that having three prominent opposition figures or are those who are pro-democracy activists, Bobby Wine, Tundu Lissu, and the rest, is basically to bash the countries where they came from, where there seem to be disagreement about the way forward democracy-wise. How do you react to that?
I think that's a valid criticism, to be sure. Obviously, we're very conscious of that criticism. So in later episodes, like I mentioned, we will have individuals from government on the continent, individuals who represent leaders who are currently in power, for instance, civil society representatives, journalists. And it's really not to bash those leaders who are in power, but to amplify the voices of some of the continent's most outspoken, courageous pro-democracy leaders, giving them a platform to not only espouse their views and their perspectives and their lessons learned, but also importantly for us is to build solidarity, not just across Africa, but across the globe.
Now, Jeff, some of these countries that you spoke about are of the view that there has to be measures, medical measures, movement restrictions, and enforcement of WHO protocols when it comes to limiting the spread of the pandemic. And that is exactly what they are doing to protect their citizens, which they said is mandated by the Constitution as a core duty for them to do. So if they are implementing these to save the people, it will be very difficult or just mere criticism that they are imposing stuff on them when all they are doing is to protect them. What do you say to that?
I think, you know, there's certain countries on the continent, for instance, who have, I think, responded quite well to the pandemic. And you see those countries and their economies slowly starting to emerge from this. But then, of course, you have others. You have countries where their leaders have really used this as an excuse to entrench their own power. I think a great example is Zimbabwe, where the current leader of that country, take one example, has been ruthlessly and violently cracking down on women activists from the pro-democracy opposition. You may have seen recently that these women were abducted and tortured. And instead of pursuing the perpetrators of this crime, they've actually charged these women and are currently detained right now for breaking coronavirus curfew. In addition to that, we've seen a similar epidemic of violence and sexual violence against women in Togo. And our co-host for this program, Farida Nabarima, who's Togolese, will certainly bring up this issue. Again, another great example is Tanzania, where the political opposition has been for many years now ruthlessly and violently clamped down on. And again, we've seen an uptick in that in recent weeks with the country's president and the ruling party certainly using the pandemic as a very convenient, expedient excuse to essentially do what they will and perpetrate the impunity that has long prevailed there.
Let me ask you this before you go, Jeff. What do you see as the objective being realized in Wednesday's show for its first episode? And subsequently, what do you see as the prospects of the impact this program will have in some of these countries that you mentioned?
You know, we plan to host some initial live discussions, for instance, our first one on July 8th and a second on July 23rd, in which we will feature frontline journalists from across the continent who are speaking truth to power and defending press freedom amid the coronavirus pandemic. As I mentioned, many leaders in Tanzania and Uganda, for example, and Zimbabwe. So what we really hope to do is create a series thereafter that really takes an in-depth look at the fight against electoral manipulation, for instance, resisting patriarchy, resisting aid dependence and stereotypes of Africa, being self-critical of ourselves, for instance, as Western international institutions being involved in Africa. We also want to take a look at this notion of the benevolent dictator, which has been in vogue recently, for instance, in Rwanda, for example. So really breaking down these notions and what it means and the impact that they have had on the continent, but most importantly, the impacts that they've had on pro-democracy forces, whether they are in the opposition or whether they are civil society, and giving a platform to these individuals who, in my experience, quite literally put their lives on the line to advance social change. So we really want to uplift their voices, amplify their voices to an international audience, and build solidarity across borders. That's really the main.
Jeffrey Smith is the founding director of Vanguard Africa, a nonprofit organization. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The Africa Cup of Nations 2021 has been rescheduled to January 2022. A press statement from the Confederation of African Football, CAF, says the date for the final tournament and the remaining matches of the qualifiers will be communicated in due course. Also, the African Nations Championship, CHAN, Cameroon 2020, has been postponed till 2021 in Cameroon. The CAF Executive Committee meeting held last week also decided that the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup will resume in September with a Final Four format. Semi-final matches will be played in a single match. Morocco will host the Final Four of the CAF Confederation Cup, while the host of the Final Four of the Champions League will be decided at a later date. Meanwhile, the Women's Africa Cup of Nations 2020 has been cancelled. In another development, CAF Women's Champions League will be launched in 2021. No details of the format were given. Also, the Under-17 Africa Cup of Nations will take place in July 2021. A new hosting bid will be launched for the Beach Soccer Africa Cup of Nations 2021. Originally, Uganda was supposed to host the tournament, but has since withdrawn. The tournament will be held either later this year or in 2021. Mogadishu Stadium in Somalia staged a football game for the first time on June 30th after 16-year closure. The home of the Ocean Stars opened with a friendly match between Amiside Hosid SC and Mogadishu City Club. The National Stadium until recently served as a base for peacekeepers deployed by the African Union to help stabilize the Horn of Africa. Hosid defeated Mogadishu City Club 2-1. Stadium Mogadishu was opened in 1977 when Somalia hosted the regional SEKAFA Senior Challenge Cup. In other football news, the Ghana Football Association announced the cancellation of the 2019-2020 football season. Ghana's football season has been on hold since March due to COVID-19, but now a decision has been finally reached to void the campaign with no promotion or demotion. Now, Asante Kotoko Sports Club and Ash Gold Sports Club will represent Ghana in next season's CAF Champions League and Confederation Cup, respectively. In Tanzania, Simba Sports Club has clinched the Tanzania Premier League title with 6 matches to spare after last Sunday's barren draw to Tanzania Prisons FC in Mbeya gave them an unassailable 19-point lead over second-placed Young Africans. This is Simba's third consecutive title and their 21st in all, and it hands them another chance to represent the East African country in next season's CAF Champions League. In athletics, a former marathon world record holder, Wilson Kipsang, has been banned for 4 years for anti-doping rule violations. According to World Athletics, between April 2018 and May 2019, the 20-year-old Kenyan, twice a London Marathon winner, had missed 4 whereabouts appointments. 3 such failures within 12 months leads to an automatic ban. Kipsang, a bronze medalist at the 2012 London Olympics, had been provisionally suspended in January for whereabouts failures and tampering by providing false evidence. He also won the Berlin, New York, and Tokyo marathons and is the 6th fastest marathon runner in history with a personal best of 2 hours, 3 minutes, and 13 seconds. He has the right, however, to appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And that's about it for this edition of Nathan Africa Sports. And now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
I can feel it in my heart. Hey, feel it in my soul. And I can feel it when we're apart. Girl, I want you to know. When I'm with you, you're all I need, you're taking over me, and I would never leave. When I'm with you, I don't ever feel like letting go, don't let me go.
So let we make a memory, we jamming. Amen. Amen, Shaki.
Habibi, I love you, I need you. Habibi, ghanini wa khallini maak. Habibi, I love you, I need you. Habibi, tu ibni naar maak. Aول مرة شفتك تغير حالي احساس غريب ما عرفت مالي بغيتك حبيتك تكون ليالي نعيش حياتي معاك نور بزاف احسن عواني لك تروح سبتي كياني كلمة حبيبي خليت بزاني غني
That was our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, he who is unable to dance blames it on the stony yard. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.